and brightest day, in blackest night, all other podcasts tremble in fright. Losers cower before the power. Orange is lust, and blues you can trust. Indigos feel, and white ones heal. Yellow scare, and green ones dare. That sapphire love and black hands glove will rock your foundation without hesitation. Chad and Mars face evil's might. Respect their power, for they'll make you see the light.
Hi, everybody. I'm Chad Bokelman.
I'm Mark Marble.
And this is the Lantern Cast.
Episode 603.
That is correct. We are diving straight into part two of this is the third annual GL June event.
Yeah.
That's right.
From the great mind of yours truly.
That's right. That's right.
Take that, Mr. Heart and Soul.
Yeah. You said we weren't going to get into that tonight.
It's alluding, Chad. It's alluding.
you started the ball. What is GL June?
You mean as a general concept, Chad?
Sure. And what is it this year? Tell them what we're covering, too.
Well, what we're covering is Green Lantern Corps Recharge from 2005, correct? That, shortly followed Green Lantern Rebirth and was the double whammy, the 1-2 punch that set the Geoff Johns era off on its merry way to give us Sinestro Corps War and Blackest Night and fun things like that. But generally speaking, it is where all our these Green Lantern podcasts, everyone in our Green Lantern family, comes together and we pick a Green Lantern centric event to cover in June every year. And this year, this happens to be the consensus choice, which I think was probably a good choice since it's a very cool and important story that kind of gets overlooked because it came out right after Rebirth.
In the 20th anniversary, because you said
yes. Yep.
That's right. There are quite a few over the years. Obviously, Lantern Cast started, actually, I say obviously, this might be some people's first time listening to the show. So, yes, Lantern Cast was actually started by two other guys named Jim and Dan. And the story goes that, way back in the day, 16 years ago, Jim wanted to listen to a podcast about Green Lantern because he was a fan of Comic Geek Speak, and participated in their community. But because there was none to listen to, he decided to create one. And through the Comic Geek Speak forums at the time, he befriended Dan Kurtzky. The two started the show, had various guests like myself and Mark on at various points. I wanted to start a Green Lantern documentary and get that off the ground and force DC to do it. Mark had a Facebook game with a partner of yours, a friend of yours, right, on Facebook when Facebook Games was actually doing things, right?
Yes, that's true. But fun back in the day.
That's true. And then, as life goes, some people get tired of doing the same thing for a while, or in Jim's case, that wife, kids, and they handed the show to the two of us, and we've been doing it for a while, so Lantern Cast was the only Green Lantern podcast for a long time, but as the popularity of Green Lantern grew and the popularity of podcasting grew, other people branched out and started doing their own thing too. And why consider ourselves enemies? We're all a fan of the same thing. So every year now, if this is the third year in a row, this was Mark's idea. We just decided to partner up and share the love.
Yes, yes. And hopefully this will continue for a while. Lord knows there's enough Green Lantern-centric, I think, stories. And especially because it's not just mining the super popular ones or the most obvious ones. We do try to spread the wealth around, and we're open to suggestions, obviously, for Green Lantern stories that maybe are off the beaten path a little bit but are still worth revisiting and putting shining that light literally and figuratively on something that maybe most people haven't read. Or if they did, they've forgotten about.
The first year was, Circle of Fire?
Yes.
And then last year, my idea, which, you know, to middling results, was the Siege of Zeeshram from the 90s or early 2000s. And now this year we have Green Lantern Corps Recharge. Part one was our friends Myron and Phil over at the Podcast of Oa. So if you are interested in learning about the start of Recharge and everything, please go listen to their episode that they put out about part one, about issue one. And we will not be commenting on the rest of this series as things go. So we're going to leave that up to our people we'll be handing this off to for the further parts. So if you want to listen to the whole thing, you got to listen to all of us. And we'll tell you a little bit later about where to find the others after we're done covering this issue. So should we just jump in?
Sounds good.
All right. Green Lantern Corps Recharge number 2, Web of Death. We have our writers, Dave Gibbons and Jeff Johns, our pencilers, Patrick Gleason, our inkers, Presentus Rollins and Christian Alme, letterer Phil Balsman, a colorist Moose Ballman, associate editor Mike Scalane, and editor Peter Tomasi. A name that would become later associated with Green Lantern Corps.
Yes.
So we open up on Mogo, where we have an overlay of some monologue or some conversation happening between the Guardians of the Universe. They are talking about how Mogo needs to be protected because with the, at the time, ongoing Rannian and Thanagarian conflict, an envoy of the Thanagarian fleet is approaching Mogo to replenish their life support resources, is what it says. And because they're at war within the same space sector, the general area, the Rannians are not far behind. So the two of them coming across the surface of Mogo in the middle of this war and conflict, Mogo's about to be brought into the center of it. So Mogo needs some backup because, and they allude to here, Mogo is very important to the core, but they don't necessarily say why here. So meanwhile, over on Oa, in the meeting hall, Kilowog pulls a bunch of the senior lanterns, as well as a bunch of the new recruits and rookies to pull up Vath and Izamot Cole from 2682, which is the sector that Rand and Thanagar are in. They are given temporary badges because they are white circles. They have not yet earned their Green Lantern badge. And, you know, if they handle this first assignment and mission, then you will become trainee Green Lanterns. There's a little bit of conflict. You want me to work with a Rannian? That Thanagarian's going to kill me, so on and so forth. Kilowog shuts that down. And then Kyle, Guy, Green Man, and Stell are all sent to the assignment to go protect Mogo, while Vath and Izamot are set to go basically babysit a dying star and make sure that nobody goes around it so when this thing goes Nova, nobody dies in their sector. But anyways, Guy and company head out to protect Mogo, and they start taking on the fleet. They are making some progress, but not fast enough for Guy's liking. So him and Kyle hatch a plan, and each one of them go and grab the commander of the respective Ran and Thanagarian fleets, toss them in a construct bubble together, and tell them to work it out. But also, hey, while you're in there, don't forget I can open this bubble in the middle of the vacuum of space and suck all the air out of here. So are you sure you want to stick around and take too long? That causes them to all part ways pretty quickly. Mogo expresses his gratitude and says, thank you, return whenever you wish, and make the pilgrimage all lanterns do, which we'll talk about later. But they go down to the surface, and because there is a call coming, sounds like, based on the bubble over the ring, it's very faint, saying, help me. So they jet down to the surface of Mogo. Meanwhile, over in a sector where Vath and Izamot are babysitting this dying star, they're sitting on an asteroid arguing amongst themselves when a ship from Okara in the Vega system approaches. It's a hospital ship, and they're trying to haul ass as quickly as possible. But because it's a Rannian and a Thanagarian, they don't trust this. So they're not listening to anything they have to say. Well, then suddenly the star that they're guarding goes critical, and we have to flash back to Mogo. So we'll come back to that in a minute. Meanwhile, down on the surface of Mogo, Green Man takes a dip because he's amphibious, and Kyle chases the voices that he's hearing into the forest, where he comes across a construct, dream, hallucination, whatever we want to call it, of his ex, Alex, who died when we first met Kyle. Shortly after we first met Kyle, he has a quick conversation, talks about how he misses her, so on and so forth, and then he keeps hearing the help, and then Alex disappears, and he suddenly sees a vision of Sorianic Natu tied up and in distress. And back over where the star exploded, a black hole has now appeared, which is the second black hole we've now seen in the series, as we saw one at the beginning of issue one. Izamat and Vath are trying to get the ship out of the gravity field by using their energy and even pulling on their own personal life support to try and do so. They fall into the black hole just in time for Kilowog to arrive there. But Kilowog does not see them, so he is able to save the ship and send it on its way, but cannot find the two lanterns, but he chases them into the black hole. So if you've ever wanted a definition of how brave a Green Lantern is, Kilowog runs face first into a black hole. Meanwhile, back over on Mogo, Kyle rejoins the group and tells them that Sora is in pain and needs help. Something is wrong with her. They can hear the call now through their rings, and they triangulate that she is in the Vega system, which the lanterns are not allowed to go to. Plus, the ring is telling them also that, you know, in issue one, Sora declined the invitation to join the Green Lantern Corps, so she's not technically a part of it, so we don't need to go over there. Plus, we're not allowed in the Vega sector anyways. Obviously, Guy and Kyle say screw that and leave Green Man and Stell behind to do their thing. Meanwhile, we find Vath and Izamat in the darkness, in a place surrounded by webs. Their rings are still lit, but faintly. And, you know, did you hear something? Let's set some light on it. And it's to be continued as they find themselves in a nest amongst lots of bones and spiders, which I don't think we can say yet who these are, because they haven't been revealed. These are the spider offspring that are not fully developed yet. So we don't know who these are, technically.
Yeah, we can say that.
I think this is as far as we can get. But either way, yeah. That is issue two.
Thanks for joining us this evening.
That is great.
It's interesting looking back at this now, just seeing that laying the foundation for a lot of the stuff with Sora and Kyle, that I didn't quite remember it being, since I haven't read this in forever, that the reality of their future relationship and all the ups and downs, and that's putting it mildly, that kind of was foreshadowed early on with the fact that Kyle was really the first one to hear her here. And in even the kind of pseudo illusion, how he's seeing Alex, even though it's really Sora who's calling out to him. So that kind of whole vision and what it means. And I thought that was pretty intriguing going back on and looking at this now.
See, my interpretation of that moment with Alex is actually that it's just Mogo doing his thing, right?
Because it could be. I mean, could be, but the fact that it transitions directly into him seeing Sora, because it's not like Sora is actually there either.
Yeah, that's true.
But I think, and again, we don't know how planned this was, that the concept of Kyle and Sora being paired up together. We don't know if this was the original plan, like all along from the beginning of when Sora was created. That this was the game plan all along, once that Sora was always meant to be a love interest for Kyle. But it was something that was that looking at it now and seeing that, you know, Kyle's the first one to really be able to hear her or feel her, that there's some connection there between the two of them, even if it's magnified because of Mogo, that still means something. Though, God, Kyle's reminds you how lousy Kyle's uniform was at this time too.
Yeah.
I don't think the artwork does a lot of people justice in this. in this issue, honestly. I think Kilowog, Vath, and Izamat maybe, but to be fair, Sora looks fine, but Guy and Kyle don't look particularly good.
Maybe, except he does a really damn good job at Guy's smug faced.
Oh yeah, and from an expression perspective, he does capture Guy's wearing his heart on his sleeve aspect of his personality. Because remember, Guy's reacting to anything, even if you don't necessarily like the way he's quote unquote drawn. There's the essence of Guy Gardner pretty much comes out in almost every panel that he's in.
Yeah. Just for those of you playing along at home, the pilgrimage lanterns do that. It kind of alludes to what Kyle's experiencing here, because anytime a lantern has, whether it's fear or trauma or grief or, you know, some sort of, especially something more mental than it is physical, although sometimes physical, that they need to address or get over, they go to Mogo, and Mogo does kind of what he's doing here with Kyle, assuming he's the source of this hallucination of Alex. He can present these images to you, and you can sort of live out these moments that you need to get over certain things or really deal with any sort of trauma that you're experiencing. It's obviously not real, but it's real enough to you that it's helpful to getting over that. So that's what he's referring to by the pilgrimage, and kind of what, that's why I'm alluding to this could be a Mogo thing that Kyle's seeing here.
There's no doubt about that. But again, the segueing it into Sora and the fact that he's able to see Sora and basically get a vision of Sora, which really is not, I don't know. It's almost like Mogo again showing Kyle what he needs to see, being the little, doing a little, psychology or analysis of Kyle, that it's that one way or the other, there's certainly either a pathway via Mogo or from Mogo, or just he's acting almost as a conduit to show, in order for Kyle to see and feel Sora, because that's what he needs to do. So,
yeah, obviously, in terms of stuff that we would get later, Izamat and Vath are two of the main names you think of outside of your critical and Earth lanterns, in terms of like your human lanterns, and then plus like Kilowog, Salak, those ilk. If you were to mention more lanterns, alien lanterns right off of that, a lot of Green Lantern fans, especially modern Green Lantern fans, would be like Izamat, Vath, Sora, like, so this is the beginning. And I seem to maybe have misremembered a little bit, because I know when they were drafted and first met, they had some animosity towards each other. Like, I'm talking the first issue, but I thought like it was double-sided the entire time. But it really feels like Izamat is the one that's pouring the hate on, and Vath is the one that's like, look, he only really lashes back out at Izamat when Izamat makes it personal. He's like, hey man, he's gonna, you want me to work with Iranian, he's gonna skewer me in the back with a spear the minute I turn my head. And he's like, I'm not gonna shoot anyone in the back, I face my opponents head on. But like, otherwise he's not giving what Izamat is. He's very much like, especially later on, he actually says it. He says, the war doesn't concern us, we're lanterns now. That's what the ring said. So, and he's even trying to figure that all out on the asteroid with Izamat, and trying to calm him down and stuff and get him to focus on the mission. But I don't know why I thought it was so equal on the part of both of them. But it seems like Izamat's the one just giving here.
Well, certainly in this issue, there's no doubt about that. I agree with that assessment or analysis. I think it's pretty clear that it's Izamat who's got the bigger grudge, or who's more biased against the other side in this. But I think we see a little bit more of the balancing out of the equation when it comes to the animosity. Because, well, let's just say the leg thing that eventually goes down, that Vath doesn't particularly take that particularly well, even though he, obviously Izamat does that solely for his own good and to help him out. But it doesn't go over particularly well. It may be different levels of animosity, and some, maybe Izamat again wears his animosity on his sleeve a lot more, while Vath is able to
internalize it.
Yeah, or or tries to make, or tries to come across, even if it's subconsciously, is, well, I'm a bigger person than this, and yeah, we have issues, but they're not so far below the surface. But I do agree there was that. I think generally speaking, and again, it's been a long time since we read these early stories.
Yeah.
That I do think. To me, I agreed. I thought the animosity was kind of like a back and forth, and just rubbing each other the wrong way all the time. And this issue isn't like that, but it still doesn't mean that recollection is, or our memories are incorrect. It's just that it may not have been how it first started upon the first introduction of the characters.
Yeah, for sure. Otherwise, I mean, I think what I like about this is just kind of, I know, because it's hard to talk about this not in the context of like the entire five issues, but if I'm just focusing on this, I mean, I think this is what I miss out of a Green Lantern comic, and we're kind of getting it because, like, as of the current issues and stuff like that, they're doing this whole power battery rebuilding thing, so they're having missions and stuff, but like just this is like, hey, there's a war that's happening out in the galaxy. Mogo's caught in the middle. He needs some help. Let's go defend him. But also, there's a collapsing star, and we need to keep civilians away from it to protect just life. It's not a big job. It turns out, obviously, without saying too much, it turns out to be related to the big central conflict of these five issues. So it turns out to be a bigger deal, but they don't know that at the time. So they're just sending out lanterns to do what lanterns should do and help people across the universe and keep an eye on this collapsing star so nobody's hurt. And it's crazy to me that we don't get these. You're familiar. I know. Yes, you are familiar with Doctor Who. Yes,
but not. Deeply, but it can.
Yeah. Well, so there's been a lot of talk about the most recent regeneration, and I'm not going to dive deep into Doctor Who lore here, or even most recent stuff, because I haven't been watching either. But I'm a part of, you know, that geek circle, so you hear about it from your friends who are still watching. And some of the people they have ideas about where things should go, and they're saying, I was reading a comment earlier today, that the Doctor and his stories, especially like the David Tennant era and stuff, they didn't all used to be related to a massive central arc, like it's the Master or something like that. It was always like he would just show up somewhere, and it would just be because the TARDIS happened to take him there and he was needed. Not that it was a critical universe-ending threat, it was just somebody needed help. And the word I think that was used was the catastrophization of everything, the increase of it, that everything had to be bigger and grander, and you had to protect things on a universal level, kept the heart and soul of the stories that you could tell with the Doctor, the one-offs, out of the equation, and that everything had to be a big universal threat. And I think that applies to current Lantern stories too. And it's been happening, obviously, with DC. We've talked about this in terms of like crisis events and stuff like that. It's not just this universe is in danger. It's the multiverse is in danger. And it's the omniverse that's in danger. We keep having to increase the threat. And I think the same, looking back on this and comparing it to the types of missions the Lanterns are going on now, and we've seen them go on in this series and then in prior series, even with Thorn and stuff, there's no like small missions anymore. It's all catastrophized.
No, I think there's truth in that. I think there's definitely truth in that, and that becomes a double-edged sword, because when you try to tell a smaller story, then it almost seems anticlimactic, because well, the payoff is going to be smaller because the risk is smaller, the threat is smaller. But if all you do is focus in on big events and big stories, and then you're constantly having to try to up the ante, which means not only do you have to try to clear the bar that you cleared before, after a while it becomes almost impossible or derivative to just say, well, here's another threat to the multiverse. This is an even bigger threat to the multiverse than the last threat to them. So, yeah, it's a fine line. Walking the line of being able to tell small stories And sometimes the small stories can lead to the, you know, are all bigger pieces of a big puzzle. One of the things that Geoff Johns was fantastic at back in his prime in the first like four to five years when he was working on the book.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. There is one other thing, because it kind of goes back. I mean, we see it a little bit in here. It kind of goes back, though, to the first issue. I have to mention it, though, because it's so ironic. Did you, I assume you read the first issue. I know we were
prepared. Yes.
But guy running in and getting pissed off that he's been assigned to help train. Didn't we just see that in the first issue?
Yeah.
Almost the exact same scene with just different people.
Yeah, that is true. It's more than, it's not even ironic. It's just nice symmetry. It's like things come full circle. It's that, even though, to be fair, in taking Guy's position in this series, Guy still doesn't know where his fortunes lie, because all we know is there's four Earth Lanterns, and supposedly, according to what Hal tells Guy, is that John Stewart and Hal Jordan are going to be assigned to 2814. So Guy, who, of course, that doesn't sit well with Guy, because Guy, from his perspective, he absolutely should be one of the two. If there's only going to be two, he should be one of them. And Kyle, you know, Kyle obviously is much more even keeled, and Kyle seems to be much more content as long as he has a role, then he's okay. That Guy really doesn't know what his role is going to be. He doesn't know. We know what Kyle and Guy are going to be assigned to, what the important role they're going to have. But still, it's completely up in the air to them and us at this point. And Guy's just kind of acting out. It's like, well, I at least want to know where I stand. And this is all you want me to do with I help save your asses, basically. And this is all you just want me to babysit or help train, which and in this instance, it makes, you know, I guess it's also similar to what's going on in Korra, because there's a massive recruitment drive then. But it's hard to be bigger than this one, because you literally you went from having like five Green Lanterns in the entire universe to not only rebuilding the Korra, but deciding to double up the Green Lanterns. So you're going from 3,600 to 7,200 just upon relaunch, and you literally had five. At the end of Green Lantern Rebirth, you literally had five.
Yeah, so. I think the last thing worth mentioning here, unless there's other stuff that you wanted to touch on, is earlier in this issue, we said we'd circle back to this. The panel, Mogo is powerful, but he lacks mobility. Now that the war has come to him, he cannot easily avoid it. We must therefore remove the war from him. His importance to the Korra is too great to allow damage to him, let alone risk his destruction. The Korra would not long endure without his sustenance. For those of you, because it's not revealed in this actual five issues we'll be covering during this GL June event, they're talking about, for a while there, I don't know if it's still in play right now, but it was revealed that Mogo is in charge of basically directing the rings to new lanterns and new recruits.
Yes.
He's sort of the sentience behind detecting that you're capable of overcoming great fear and sending it to the right people.
Yes, that and it's hard to remember exactly when all those pieces fell into place where Mogo's role was kind of established in this capacity. But yes, that's kind of been the modern day role for Mogo for like the last 20 years, give or take. That he's very, very important in the selection process. And while the Guardians and everybody, they create the rings, but ultimately Mogo's the one who helps direct them where they're supposed to go. And to find the recruits, as Chad said. So if something were to happen to Mogo, that obviously would impact and potentially derail any massive recruitment drive, certainly of the caliber of recruits that you're looking to get, especially if you're doing what they're doing now, which is trying to literally rebuild an entire Korra times two, double its size in a really short period of time.
For sure. Other than that, I just got to say it was so nostalgic reading this, and I it made me want to, because I did end up buying one of those book stands, and I really want to bust open these omnibuses from the Geoff Johns era and just tear through it all again.
You do that, Chad. Go for it. Go for it, Chad.
But I think that's going to do it for this, unless you have any final thoughts.
No, I don't think for this issue that I do. This whole story, but this issue in particular, one of the reasons I like this issue was the fact it does kind of lay the foundation for what we were going to get pretty much in what the Tomasi run for the Tomasi Gleason era, or what, however we want to define, you know, the core book that started, that came out of this book, that this led into the Green Lantern core book, just like Green Lantern Rebirth led into the monthly Geoff Johns Green Lantern book. Green Lantern Rebirth led to Green Lantern, and Recharge led to core. So it was nice revisiting this, and it's a cool story. And like you mentioned too, it's the idea that dealing with a threat that is big enough to be worthy of the Green Lantern Corps, but no, and not every single threat. I mean, oh my God, the whole universe is necessarily crumbling, or everything's the whole universe is coming to an end. If for every single challenge that's laid before them, that's what the stakes are. Sometimes it's more personal, sometimes it's smaller, but still important what's at stake. So I think this kind of reminded you of that too, this story.
Yeah, for sure. Well, if you folks out there listening want to follow along with coverage to the next issue, you're going to follow us along from here to the Emerald Echo podcast with our friends Donnie and Adam. It was, I believe it's part of the Multiverse Musings Network, although I just Googled Emerald Echo, and now I'm seeing an association with something called Tales from the DC Multiverse. So it might not be Multiverse Musings anymore. They might have rebranded that overall header, but it's still Emerald Echo podcast with Donnie and Adam regardless. So follow them over to where you can find them across the internet, like Podbean or Apple Podcasts, or really anywhere you can find their content. They will be taking over with issue 3. And then from there, our friend Will over at the Green Lanterns podcast will take over issue 4. And then obviously over on YouTube, Mosaic Comics, that's Dan. Dan will wrap things up with issue 5 at the end of the month. So definitely listen all throughout the entirety of the month of June to all our different shows and all our different mediums. And of course, if you follow one of us on social media, as others in the lineup, you know, release our content, we will, you know, share those posts so that you can find them there too. So if you follow one of us, you should be able to find a link somewhere to the other episodes in the lineup.
All for one and one for all.
That's right. You know what, Mark? I'm going to take advantage of our wider audience, and I'm going to ask something. If anybody has anybody in that they know or can reach out to in DC Studios or part of Nathan Fillion's team, we would love to invite Nathan Fillion onto the show. This is not the first time we've wanted him on the show, obviously. I want to say, for those of you who don't know, Nathan Fillion is a longtime actual fan of the franchise of Green Lantern, far before he was ever cast as Guy Gardner. And I would say far before he was ever cast in the role of voice acting Hal Jordan in a lot of the animated features from DC. The man has been a reported Green Lantern fan forever, and this show has been on the air for 16 years. It is crazy to me that we haven't had Nathan Fillion on the show once.
Yeah, that would be a big coup. That would be a big coup.
You know what? Is it likely? Probably not. It's hard to reach out to people at that level. I'm sure everybody out there could agree. But if there happens to be somebody with a connection out there, I don't want to miss the opportunity to ask for it, because honestly, I could not, he could tell his publicist or whatever could say, you're not allowed to ask any questions about the Superman movie. I would still have so much to ask him about Green Lantern.
That is probably true. And we'll gladly take Nathan filling in like times 3 versus Ryan Reynolds times 1.
For sure.
Lord knows.
But the episode isn't over. So what else do we want to talk about tonight?
So I know we have something else Green Lantern related we're probably going to get to, because we should have time. But let me delve into kind of what I do best at times. So let's go talk about what Mark has seen. Now, obviously, for people who don't listen to the show, we often talk about movies on the show, not always with exclusive episodes, even though the last episode we did was, Jim and I did a Lilo and Stitch episode and we had some MCU talk at the end, because that was right after the Avengers movies got pushed back. But sometimes they're just small little snippets, like this is going to be about things that I've seen that don't deserve full review episodes. So in the last week, I've seen two. So I saw Karate Kid Legends. Karate Kid Legends was probably slightly better than I expected it to be. I didn't have great expectations of that movie. I was looking forward to it, but I didn't think it was going to be a classic or anything close to it. I think Ben Wong was really good as the lead character. I think he was very likable. I think, actually, in all honesty, the majority of the casting for that movie worked, I think. The writing wasn't always the best. Like, the adversary, the bully, was particularly underwritten. But the most of the major characters that were in the movie were written well, including Macchio coming back as Daniel and Jackie Chan coming back as Mr. Han. I liked it. I do think that probably the reason why it's not doing as well financially is the main reason why people would have had an interest in seeing the movie to begin with, which was, other than towards the end, there really is nothing referencing the events of Cobra Kai at all in the movie. So they never marketed as if there was going to be, but I think that's what a lot of people who watched the show on Netflix wanted. And I think that would have probably, I think it certainly would have helped the box office if they had had a little bit more carryover from the TV show into the movie, which theoretically I'm sure they could have done relatively easily if they had wanted to. And you can make a case that wouldn't have been a Karate Kid Legends, certainly not now, if not for the popularity of Cobra Kai over the last 3 to 4 years, probably. I think it's good. Do you really need to see it on the big screen? No, I don't think so. So if you're debating about it and you're not really sure, and since it's Sony, it's a Sony movie, the odds are it will be on Netflix not too long down the road. So I would say you don't need to see it in the theater, but it's not. But I think if you enjoy the basic Karate Kid concept, I think you would enjoy it if you do see it. So that's how. And then I saw Mission Impossible. We saw Final Reckoning on Monday night. We just saw it a couple of nights ago. Oh my God. That movie, the one thing I will give credit to is that they do a lot of tie-ins to this movie with events that have happened in the previous movies. They do a lot of connective tissues, which at times have done, I think, in previous movies, but they blatantly tie in things that happened way back in the first movie and things that happened. I forget which number of movie it was. There's been so many of these now, but they do tie a lot of characters and plot points in. So I give them. So if it is the last one, which I would be willing to bet you it won't be, that if it is, they do a nice job of closure there. I guess to me, the only real negatives here is the movie is really, really long. I'm not going to say it's boring, but it's really long. We're talking, it's essentially a 3-hour movie. And I don't really think it necessarily needed to be a 3-hour movie. And the only other thing I would say is, I know it's out of necessity, which sometimes you get away with in this, but there's one character in particular that kind of came aboard with the team last part in what, Dead Reckoning, that character was pretty much hit or miss, or mostly miss, as far as whether they really were on Team Ethan or not until the very end of the movie. And now in this movie, it's like, oh, 100% they're part of Team Ethan. And it just seems a little, I know it's circumstance, and you can make a case it's kind of like the enemy of my enemy is my friend and things like that. So, and politics makes strange bedfellows, that concept too. But I didn't necessarily like how two characters in particular were particularly ingrained into the team dynamic compared to how they started. But I guess that's how you grow things. It's very much like Fast and Furious, I guess, on that level. The people that were on the outside, or maybe even bad guys, just at certain points end up being part of the group. But nonetheless, that's another one. I guess if you could see it in IMAX, I guess it would be cool seeing it on the big screen in IMAX, since it was shot and made for IMAX. But it was good. I think that franchise is what it is. It's very well made, and you respect Tom Cruise for always literally putting his body on the line to make these things. But it's never been a particularly financially highly viable franchise. So this movie cost way too much for this movie probably to ever come close to making money during its theatrical run. But it's a high quality movie, and at least you respect the fact that at least he's a movie star, in the sense that he certainly does everything he can to not only help his movies, but the industry as a whole. And he kind of champions, for whatever his personal faux pas is and what you think of him personally, the reality is he does try to keep the focus on the movies and the projects and the business not bringing it like his own personal politics or his own personal beliefs into marketing the movie you're talking about this. He seems to have a lot more focus than almost anybody else does these days. So I think you at least have to respect that. And that's it.
All right. I don't have anything to add to that because I did buy the new Captain America movie on Blu-ray. You know that, but I haven't watched it yet. I will be watching it this weekend. That's my plan at the very least. So big news, guys. I will be watching something soon.
Spoiler alert.
But there's that. So should we talk about a bit of the Lanterns? Well, news and rumors, I guess, because I guess the casting hasn't been 100% confirmed, right?
Yeah, but I'm trying to remember where the source was. It's probably confirmed because almost all these additions to the cast have not been officially announced the way because actually, technically speaking, even the Kyle Chandler thing wasn't as officially announced as the Jon Stewart casting was. I can remember we talked about that. And there was that James Gunn like made a big deal about the Jon, which tells you all you probably need to know about where they're going from a focus perspective. But I think he made the big deal of welcoming Jon Stewart aboard, but he didn't really do the same for Kyle Chandler. But I think we probably can assume it's especially since we know it's filming at this point, that it's not just a rumor.
Yeah, the rumor is that Laura Linney has been cast in Lanterns. Now the thought is that she will be playing Carol Ferris by a lot of us, but we don't know that, just as much as we don't know that for sure she's part of the show, supposedly. But I saw that, and I know her, back in the day she was a part of Frasier and stuff like that, but she was lots of different projects, and I really like her as an actress. I think she's got a very expressive face. She in some of the roles I've seen her, and I'm going through her IMDb right now trying to figure it out. She played an absolute bitch in something, and she just did such a great job at it that when you come away going, God, I hate that fucking character, the actor's doing a great job. So I do remember that. I remember liking her in a lot of the things that I've seen her in. I just can't recall for the life of me. One of them, The Life of David Gale.
The Life of David Gale does stand out, just like Primal Fear stands out.
Yeah.
Laura Linney is terrific. She's terrific in almost anything. So if it's true, not just that she's on the show, but if it turns out she is Carol, that would be nice.
It brings some actual quality acting. Like you know, there's going to be, if the problem's there, it's got to be with something else other than her.
Yeah, that is true.
You would think.
Well, it also makes you wonder about what exactly is going to be going on, unless there's going to be some flashbacks here, that mm-hmm. where all these characters are going to be coming into play, considering the main story is like in this like West Bumfuck or whatever, this town, and it's like in the Midwest, right? They're supposed to be like in the Midwest in this mystery.
I believe so.
That's supposed to have these big ramifications down the road for the, they uncover a mystery that has, huge ramifications for the DCU as a whole. But it still makes you wonder how the hell, Sinestro factors into this, and how, if Laura Linney is really playing Carol, how that factors into it. It is somewhat fascinating to try to put that together, which there's no way we can at this point until we start watching the show. But yes, I think that's very good. Good casting. I think overall the show does have a good cast, so that's a plus.
Yeah, it's like Kyle Chandler. We know he's a good actor.
Yeah.
I forget the guy's name off the top of my head. The guy who's playing John, he was just in something that a lot of people loved, right?
Yeah, that Netflix thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. So like in terms of people being able to pull off, emotion on a page, or being able to hopefully have some nice chemistry on screen, I would hope that, feelings aside about the age of some of these actors and stuff that we've been talking about ad nauseum since the original casting announcements, were made. Putting that aside for the moment, we do have actual quality actors as a part of this show.
Aaron Pierre is who we were looking for.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I think the cast... The cast doesn't concern me. It's some of the creators that concern me. you hope because what this is going to be the first live action show under the gun regime, that you would like to think that he's going to have a lot of oversight on this. So he was pretty happy with the story to begin with, that. He's not going to Kevin Feige it the way Kevin Feige has in phases 4 through 6, which is signing off on bad projects and probably not really knowing, letting the inmates run the asylum too much to the point where it's too late to fix things when you realize, oh my God, what the hell do they do? That doesn't seem to be James Gunn's MO. And plus it's like hitting the ground running, that even though he's not writing it, which would have made me much happier if he had been, that I do have some hope. But yeah, having Lindelof and King involved in this, it does make me nervous. But we will see.
Oh, The Truman Show.
Oh, yes, right. Yes, that's right. She wasn't. I never saw that movie, but yes, she. You're right. Yeah. She is in there. She's in a lot of stuff.
Huge movie guy. How have you never seen The Truman Show?
It never really appealed to me as a concept. And I'm really selective when it comes to Jim Carrey.
Gotcha.
So I think I'm looking at her. She was in. I almost forgot she was in The Exorcism of Emily Rose.
I haven't seen a lot of the stuff on this list.
Mystic River. Yep. I remember that. The Nanny. I almost forgot. Wasn't she a bitch? She was a bitch in The Nanny Diaries, I think.
Maybe. I'm ashamed to say it. One of her credits on here is actually from the Michael Bay Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movies, the second one, Out of the Shadows. I do remember her in that. I think she was like the police commissioner of New York or something like that. She's the one who allowed the turtles to deal with the thing and let the police step aside or something like that. I don't know. It was some crazy shit. Controversial opinion time. I thought you had to pick a Michael Bay TMNT movie, I thought Out of the Shadows was better than the first one. But that's neither here nor there.
Neither here nor there. And the Mothman Prophecies. She was fantastic in the Mothman Prophecies. Almost forgot she was in Congo too. She's been in so much.
She's credited as a big part of Ozark. I haven't seen it, but I know a lot of people who like it. So there's that. Mark and I were talking about this earlier. There is a DC Studios podcast essentially over on YouTube. The DC Studios Showcase, the official podcast. It's got Max branding and all kinds of crap on it. So I'm assuming their own little kind of internal PR circle or whatever. But episode 13 has Isabella Merced, who's playing Hawk Girl, as well as Nathan Fillion on it. And I read an article that pulled a quote from this podcast. I haven't yet watched it yet, but the quote is Nathan is quoted as saying, part of his origin, Guy Gardner, he was at one point hit by a bus and was in a coma. So I just say that's the thing that flipped the switch. That's the thing that caused a little bit of brain damage. Now he's just off a little bit, end quote. Now he's assuming, because I've watched part of this interview, so I think I'm up to the point right before he says this. He is talking about going back reading some Green Lantern stuff and earlier Guy Gardner stuff, talking about how sexist and, you know, whatever it was back in the 80s. But he really appreciates the 90s development and the, you know, he talks the aughts as well, 2000s era of Guy Gardner and the development there. So I assume that he starts talking about some of the stuff he read in a little bit more detail there. But that is a big part of Guy Gardner's origin. I think it's Silver Age, right? Is when he gets hit by the bus, and then we don't see him again for such a long time until it's, well, it's the final issue of what was actually titled Green Lantern, Green Arrow, right? Because he, Hal was about to marry Carrie Limbo, and then Guy showed up, having just awakened from his coma.
I think that's correct, but again, I can't 100% vouch to certify your history recollection, but I trust you well enough on when it comes to
this. Yeah, I think it was retconned at one point because I think Sinestro was messing with him mentally when he was in a coma or whatever. But then I think it might have been retconned to it was Zod who did it or something. But either way, you know, whether it was he was being, you know, his subconscious state was being tortured by Sinestro or Zod, or just the fact that he got hit by a bus and was in a coma for so long is enough to have him be a little mentally off. I think it's almost reads like they're taking that as like an off-screen canon part of Guy's origin.
It sounds like that's what he's implying, yeah.
Yeah. I just thought that was, I mean, it's obviously not groundbreaking news or anything, but in a movie that's called Superman, getting news about Guy Gardner in any facet is probably worth sharing for the Lantern audience.
That is true.
Now, what do you think about that? Does that help you, hinder you, make you, you know, more excited, not excited to see the depiction? Because, I mean, we've seen the trailers and stuff, so focusing on the Guy scenes in particular, I mean, he seems to have the mannerisms down. He's, you know, flicking his wrist and a giant construct hand shoots out of the ground and tosses a bunch of soldiers aside, and he's literally just dismissing them with a wave of his hand and, you know, that's a very Guy Gardner type thing to do. So I think what we've visually seen aligns with it. So I don't know if learning this bit of off-screen backstory being so close to the original continuity helps me in any way or not.
It shows respect on some, obviously on a certain level. I guess my only concern is, but then again, we don't have to worry about long-term future for many of these characters because they're being cast as so old to begin with. But if Guy had been younger, let's say if this was 30-something Guy, that the only concern I would have then would be, well, it doesn't necessarily allow for the character development naturally without some kind of, I'm sure it's DC, they could come up with some kind of retcon that he gets healed or whatever. Maybe say Walker can heal him. That the reality is, my only concern would be it doesn't allow for the growth of the character that we've seen Guy become pretty much since. It certainly kicked into high gear after Green Lantern Rebirth, even though we know from reading during the Kyle era that the rehabilitation of Guy Gardner as a character really started back in the 90s. Yeah. But it really took on a whole new level from pretty much Green Lantern Rebirth all the way through to now. That the Guy Gardner we have now in so many ways is nothing close to the Guy Gardner that he was then. Does he have some of the same personality traits? Yes. But Guy Gardner is much more competent and he's much more likable and he's much less douchey than he was, you know, in the 80s and the beginning of the 90s. So the reality is, I just wonder if that takes away, if they wanted to have any real character growth, unless they're going to have it be where because of the damage that sometimes almost like a split, not truly a split personality thing, but that sometimes he has moments when he's kind of like not the old Guy Gardner, the pre-injury Guy Gardner kind of shines through that. Yeah. I don't know, but that would be my only concern. But I do like the fact that at least they're kind of delving into actual history as opposed to just making up something to kind of retconning the origins. They still get you to the same point. I'm glad given the choice they stuck with going back to the going old school.
Yeah, I will say, because what you said there kind of reminded me, flashing back just a moment to Green Lantern Corps Recharge. Something I forgot to say about that, what's really important about Recharge and then just the Tomasi Gleason era of Green Lantern Corps is I'm a Kyle Allen Hal guy. I don't hate John or Guy or whatever. I have appreciation for them. I didn't have appreciation for Guy until after this series that we talked about today, or during it rather. I think the Tomasi Gleason era did so much for Guy Gardner, at least for me personally, in making him a character I really enjoyed and could see past the bullshit into, you know, the guy who loved the core, who treated Kyle like a brother, you know, so on and so forth. The stuff that we saw throughout that run in Green Lantern Corps, and then, you know, once we got into events like Sinestro Corps War and Blackest Night and Brightest Day and all the crossovers between the titles. So obviously we saw him on other series and stuff. Just that era just kept me on this steady incline and going, oh, I think I get Guy a little bit more, and I think I appreciate him a little bit more. And I you know, I definitively say it locked in for me that Guy was a Lantern I could finally appreciate when the Emerald Warriors short-lived series came out, and then of course when Charles Soule took over for the Red Lanterns, for sure. Those two, because they were pretty much in quick succession there for a little bit. That section of Guy's history, Emerald Warriors, which was only like, what, 12 issues or something like that?
Something like that. That was another unfortunate casualty of the destined to fail New 52 launch era.
Yeah. And then when he became a Red Lantern in the Charles Soule era of the Red Lantern series, that's when I was like, I am 100% on board. But I cannot deny the groundwork that Gleason and Tomasi put in to get me to that point.
No, I completely understand and I respect that opinion. Emerald Warriors is kind of it's unfortunate that show that book didn't last that long. But again, it's not because it wasn't a good book, and it's not because it wasn't selling. It was just because they unfortunately, it was a casualty of, hey, let's do the New 52, 13 issues. It was 13.
We should flash back to that, because when we talk and reflect about, you know, reflect back about, you know, other series and stuff, and we talk about even like the short-lived 6 issues of freaking when they were in the other universe, the freaking
Lost Army.
Yes, Lost Army. It was such a shame that he didn't get more time to tell that whole story in the full 12 issues. We still talk about just those 6 issues, or we talk about the Sinestro run, or how many times have we flashed back to talk about Emerald Warriors? It's almost like we forgot about that series.
Well, yeah, it makes a lot of sense that it's forgotten because of when it, you know, it started during Brightest Day.
Mm-hmm.
Under the Brightest Day label, and then it led right, you know, obviously it wrapped up pretty much at the end of the War of the Green Lanterns, and then it got canceled as far as which was more than a little ironic when you had the new 52 had so many books at their peak, so many Lantern books, even though they weren't that many to start with. So, well, actually, that's not true. There were some that were there to start with, and then it's just after Geoff Johns left is when they had the upheaval about the creative teams and things like that. But like Red Lanterns wasn't good to start with, and then it got better. And New Guardians was there pretty much in the New 52, but it switched directions and things like that. But yeah, it was because I'm looking at the cover for Emerald Warriors 1, which has Gantet and Atrocitus in the background, because it reminds you that there was some secret deal between the three of them, which I kind of...
Yeah, they had a secret meeting and made a deal, yeah.
Yeah, which I completely forgot about, and I even without really reading the synopsis, just seeing the cover, it's like, oh, that's why they're on the cover, because, yeah, there was this deal that was made, which I assume was probably in Blackest Night, I'm going to assume, somewhere in Blackest Night, or the very, very end of Blackest Night. But yeah, it was.
I don't think it was ever fully collected either, because we got Volume 1, but I don't think Volume 1 had all the issues.
Yeah, you could be right about that. It is, yeah. but you also were correct. It is something that is something probably worth looking back on at some point.
For sure. All right. Well, people have tuned in to hear GL June again, guys. Please, please, please follow from this episode over to Emerald Echo for Donnie and Adam to talk about issue 3. But in the meantime, Mark, if people want to reach out to us or learn a little bit more about us or whatever, what do people do?
Lanterncast@gmail.com. The website is lanterncast.com. That's for everybody not named Jamie. You are banned. And about 100 episodes, you'll get this message. You can follow us on Blue Sky, Twitter, Like us on Facebook. Use hashtag GLcast to track us down. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, wherever you listen to us on. Please leave us a positive review. Last but not least, if you'd like to leave us a text or a voicemail, 708-LANTERN, and let us know what you think.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.